ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Solera Report. This is John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. It's Money and Markets. We're recording on July 13th, and tomorrow is July. Take it away, John.
July, it's Bastille Day, July 14th.
That's right.
And that's our theme, Happy Bastille Day.
Yep. It's, you know, we've had July 4th in the United States. Now we have Bastille Day in France, and it's a reminder to celebrate independence.
Boy, is it ever. And there's a lot of fireworks going on around the globe right now, which is why we chose that theme.
Time to get on the barricades. Anyway.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, so start us off with war in the Ukraine.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show today. We got a lot of stuff to cover, but we start. Yeah, it's a lot of crazy stuff. There's a graph in a story this week. I'm kind of really excited about that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we always have graphs, but there's one in a story. It's like that's the story. Anyway, okay, let's get into it. War in the Ukraine. Let's go. Putin signs decree offering Russian citizenship to all Ukrainians. This is Voice of America. Normally, I probably wouldn't probably discount this, but I consider this more like an admission more than anything else by the U.S. government. Here's the deal. All Ukrainians can now apply for fast-track Russian citizenship, according to a decree signed Monday by Putin. Previously, this option had only been open to the regions they were trying to save, Donetsk and Luhansk. And I thought it went on with more, but that's basically it. Is he's opened it up. Everybody's saying, you know, it's open season coming, you know.
So here's what the folks in Eastern Europe have told me. And that is, you know, the EU has said since 2014, the EU has allowed tremendous number of Ukrainians to immigrate. And certainly since the war started, they basically offered residency in the West to anybody who wanted it. So we've seen a huge migration. The people who couldn't migrate were the ones who were military age eligible. So men in the military or men eligible to join the military. And apparently there's 7,000 military troops who are missing. And of course, the theory is that they are AWOL. And what he's doing is he's offering Russian citizenship. So all the men who can't leave and go to the EU can now get a Russian passport and basically leave the military, just walk off.
Yeah.
So because I would describe this as tendering for the Ukrainian military. I think it's a very clever move.
I agree. Ukraine's losing that war so badly. Right. It's such a cynical war. NATO basically fighting the war to the last Ukrainian. You know, you can't get out. If you're a male of Ukraine, you're going to be conscripted into the war and it uses cannon fodder. And this is a way out.
This is your way out. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Next story. Let's hit it on Ukraine. U.S. spending to counter Russian war effort exceeds first 5 years of war costs in Afghanistan. Interesting that they would pick 5 years, almost like it's arbitrary just to take a poke at the war. The Biden administrations and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have pledged to counter Russia's war in Ukraine and the threat it poses to European security and funds so far. Let me stop that. Committed to Kiev already exceed U.S. costs for the first 5 years in Afghanistan. And then you go on down, and it's interesting, these numbers. The Pentagon on Friday confirmed that the U.S. has provided $8 billion in security assistance since Russia's invasion in February. But Washington has committed to spending far more. Earlier this year, Congress committed to spending $54 billion in traditional aid, foreign aid, and military assistance in a move to help squash Putin's offensive. The funds will largely be divided through traditional channels to support Ukraine, but will also provide support to NATO nations and U.S. troops stationed in Europe. So, you know, it's basically a free-for-all on that money. Right.
So there's another announcement this afternoon here that the Democrats are asking for another big round of funding. And I continue to be very skeptical that all this money is going to the Ukraine. I think the Ukraine is just a laundering stop. And I would love to know where that money is really going.
Right. And we've said for a long time on this program that Ukraine is just basically a cesspool. You take all the worst abuses in the U.S.,
right,
put them offshore in Ukraine, and you get, you know, without transparency at all over there, it's just that much worse.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of which, that's in line, totally in line with our next story in Ukraine. Russian military defense release on U.S. biological activity in Ukraine, June 16, 2022. By way of background, the Russian MOD does weekly releases on what's going on with these biological labs. And this is an update on that. This is an American blog here. It's very interesting. I'm just going to highlight two examples of what was sort of going on in these labs run by the U.S. in Ukraine. Number one, experiments on mentally ill people. And you can see here, you know, Russia documents all this stuff. I'll get another color here in a minute. But they're not just slinging allegations. They've got photographs. They go to these facilities and they unearth all sorts of documents. They point out this is a violation of the Nuremberg Code. They show a black site experimental lab, Kharkov, a $4 million facility built with funds from the Pentagon, disguised as a pharmaceutical facility. The $4 million seems low. These allegations are not to be taken lightly. The punishment for the accused crime is death, okay? That's just one example. There are seven. I'm going to scroll down farther just to get in back to the graph point. This is brought up by the Russian MOD, Military Defense, Ministry of Defense. Hunter Biden's lobbying of Metabiota, another company we've covered on here. Again, they show that they laying out the evidence here. Pertaining to this slide, Russia says, we have already noted that Hunter Biden was instrumental in creating the financial opportunity to work with pathogens in Ukraine by securing funds for Black and Veatch and Metabiotic companies. Now, they accused the Russians accused the Democratic Party, including Commander-in-Chief Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Also feature as a main investor of Metabiota is none other than Bill Gates via his foundation. So the Russians are just letting them have it over there, finding this stuff.
So I forget where the reference was, but apparently they're going to be doing big briefings closer to the election. I'm sure this is still the tip of the iceberg.
No, you know it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But they're all over this. And it really, you think about like why, you know, why is the U.S. so concerned about Ukraine? Yeah, this has got to be a big, big part of it. The dirty laundry.
If you look at all the tensions related to the trade issues around the sanctions with India and a variety of other countries who are not direct parties to this, the information about the biowarfare really does take the moral authority out of the U.S. sails. I don't know if you saw that clip of Bolton on being interviewed on one of the sort of corporate media TV shows where he explains, he was saying, he was talking about the January 6th committee, and he was saying, look, I've engineered coup d'etats. They're very hard to engineer. It takes a lot of work. And he specified not in this country, but in other countries. And this was not, you know, this was not an engineered coup. And because, you know, it didn't involve enough planning, enough work or nothing, you know, wasn't big enough. But here he is on a corporate media admitting that as a member of the national security establishment, he has designed and developed and created and engineered coup d'etats around the world. It's like, OK, thank you, John. Did you just say this on corporate TV?
Yeah. Here are my credentials. You know, I know what I'm talking about because I've engineered coups.
Exactly. That's what he said. Yeah. It was jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a fan. Okay. Let's move on to space military global turf wars. Here we get into really the theme of the show, Happy Bastille Day. This is starting in Sri Lanka. This is pretty straightforward. The president to quit after palace stormed by angry protesters. You know, there's some controversy about what happened, but certain things are undisputed. And in this case, there we go. Sri Lankan president announced he would step down late Saturday night after thousands of protesters rushed his official residence and offices earlier in the day. So no dispute there. He has taken refuge in an undisclosed location, possibly on a naval ship. Pretty straightforward. And that's just one country of many where you've seen trouble at the top.
If you look at thousands of protesters swarming up to the presidential palace, it really looks like the movie World War Z. It's scary. Yeah,
it does. It does. You're right. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, I'm still digging in and trying to figure out the true story of what happened, and we really don't know. But one thing I can say is when it's like the water buffalo in my favorite video, Battle of Kruger, when the water buffalo get up the courage and decide to move as a herd, watch out. So yeah, that's right. What's happening. Right.
Okay, let's shift gears to, we'll just shift focus to UK. Here we go. Simple headline from Economist, Clownfall.
The Economist has really decided to, they really decided to destroy Boris Johnson, and they've done it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're not pulling any punches there. You've got your own cartoonist who, on the same topic, another interesting take on Boris. Here's Klaus. Get me another one.
Yeah, so this is Bob Moran, who I love. I think he was fired. He was fired by, I think, The Telegraph. One of the top London papers fired him about a year ago, and he lets his daily cartoons be used for free on the internet. He's very funny. But, this is my interpretation of what happened. I think you're watching a couple of leaders, one of which was Johnson, who've used up their political capital. And if you look at whatever they're planning to do in the fall, they're out of the political capital and not mean enough for what they want. So I think Johnson's out. We'll see who comes in.
So you think another, because, you know, as we're going to see in a second, it's not limited to, or a couple stories, it's not limited to the UK, you know, leaders getting in trouble. You think another round the leaders is coming in and they're going to be just that much meaner.
Right. Yeah. Because all these leaders have used up all their political capital. So you're looking to put in a whole new layer of meanies. That's what I think.
I guess my question is, what would lead you to believe they'll be meaner than the current crew?
What is it? You know, it's hard to tell. I know what they want.
One thing would be is things are getting worse.
Well, they're looking to do a new wave in the fall. And the question is, will it be war? Will it be pandemic? But a new wave is coming. And to do it, they need someone who has no, you know, the problem with Boris Johnson, he had trouble delivering the lies convincingly. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, and that's what gave him his clownish feel.
He had a problem with convincing on kind of a lot of things.
Right. So he wasn't good at delivering the cult lines. No. I think they're looking for a hitman who's, you know, who will deliver the cult lines with no compunction.
No compunction.
Yep. No compunction. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Interesting. Well, there's rumors of Macron too.
Yeah. You know? I think Macron's in real trouble. Yep. If there was a way to move Biden out, they would. You know, it's easy to move somebody out in London, given the sort of the transition process. Macron could bite the dust, too. I don't see how they get rid of Biden. Biden's approval polls are just, I mean, they just keep going down.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but he's not as low as...
Exactly. They're not as low as Carter.
Well, they're not as low as the media. If you look at the media's polls, they're significantly worse than Biden.
Yeah, but media is not running for office. You know?
Right, right.
So right. He's got about 10 points until he achieves the nadir reached by Jimmy Carter. It's amazing, isn't it? Anyway.
I think he might go through Carter.
We'll see. That 10 points is a lot. Because now you're down to the true homers. You know, the people just in just severe denial. Right.
Right.
It's going to, those 10 points, those are cab miles. Good luck.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll keep it going. Let's go to Japan. This is terrible. Former Japanese Prime Minister Abe shot in chest during event in Nara, rushed to hospital. Not much here. He stepped down as Japan's Prime Minister in 2020. He was delivering a speech when two gunshots were heard and he collapsed on the stage. He was Japan's longest serving premier. And he announced his resignation in August 2020 due to poor health. And then this is interesting down here, the last part. He's a political blue blood who was groomed to follow in the footsteps of his grandfather. His political rhetoric often focused on making Japan a normal and beautiful nation with a stronger military and a bigger role in international affairs. So not much controversial there, really, with him.
So I just finished reading the Corbett report on him. You know, James lives in Japan, so we were hoping he might have something. I'm still shaking my head on this one. So Abe was still very active and very influential in politics. So he was very much involved. I think he still had a seat in the Diet, but he, you know, he was seen as somebody who was globalist supportive. So not that controversial in terms of the, you know, and he's a big supporter of the Quad. So that's more weapon sales. Why would you be against that? His party won big in the election the Sunday after he was assassinated. But I think we're all, you know, James didn't have a clear view on it and is still collecting intelligence. And I'm still shaking my head. I don't understand what this one is about.
Yeah. There's no right. I don't either. Well, I can't even venture a hypothesis on this.
Well, one thing is you're watching a lot more pushback to the globalist agenda happening in Japan. And Japan is really getting squeezed by the export of the inflation badly. So I think there's more pushback from the population. And it may mean they want somebody meaner. I'm telling you, I see a push to get people in place who are really going to be mean.
Yeah, but he's already out.
No, but he's so influential in the policymaking.
Wow.
Yeah. No, okay. He's still very actively influential behind the scenes.
The fact that Corbett isn't coming up with anything is sort of underscores the mystery.
Right.
He's there.
So the one thing I will say, I've seen too many articles describing how easy it is for a lone assassin to kill someone. And whenever they promote the words lone assassin more than a couple times.
Yeah, right. I get it.
I'm not saying lone assassins can't happen, but it's very rare. Usually these are professional. So not to say there isn't a patsy, but, you know, it's a professional operation. So I don't know. Yeah. I think we're just going to have to see if the truth can emerge. Sometimes it takes a long time.
Yeah, well, we'll get into the operations in a later story with these.
Right.
Events. Okay, let's keep it going. This next one's got to unnerve some powers that be. Boy, RBI, the Royal Bank of India, or Reserve Bank of India, announces measures for international trade settlement in rupees. It said on Monday, asked banks to put in place additional arrangements for export and import transaction in India rupees in view of increasing interest of the global trading community in the domestic currency, in order to promote the growth of global trade with emphasis on exports from India, in other words, if you want our stuff, and to support the increasing interest in global trading community of the Indian rupee, it has been decided to put in place an additional arrangement for invoicing, payment, and settlement of exports, imports in the rupee, according to the statement. For settlement of trade transactions, the concerned banks will require special rupee Vostro accounts and correspondent banks of the partner trading country. So in other words, this is a repeat or replicating what Russia did with Gazprom and the ruble.
Right. And so to the extent that you see China, India, Russia all moving away from the dollar as the vehicle of trade, in addition to as a vehicle for reserves. Now, I doubt that this is going to be big volume at first, John, but as a structural matter, this is very important, particularly when you see it in the context of the BRIC nations starting to move to create a basket currency. So this is a big step away, and it's a big step away by a country that's always tried to play the middle of the road.
Yes.
Right.
Very good point.
Right.
Right. Yeah, they're on Russia's side on this one. People are moving away from the dollar big time.
I don't think India is on Russia's side. I think India is on the side of being productive. In other words, the beauty of the dollar system in Bretton Woods was it created a highly liquid playing field for everybody. When you go in 2012 from being a liquid system to weaponizing it and using sanctions, it starts to interrupt productivity. It starts to interrupt trade. It starts to make things too complicated. It starts to make things too, the friction gets higher and higher and the productive get more and more frustrated. And it's the same thing frustrating the Indians as frustrating the plumbers, you know, in Tennessee who don't want to have woke bathrooms. You know, they just see the whole thing as a complete waste of time and money, which it is.
Yeah.
So I think this is the Indians. I think the Indians can stay relatively in the middle of the road and be like this. But what it shows is the world just has to move on with their lives and they can't wait for the United States to become agreement capable.
Right. It's a preemptive move by India saying, you're not doing that to us.
Right. We're walking. They're walking.
We're not even going to give you a chance to screw us.
Right. Now, what this tells me is what I've seen all along, which is the institutional support for Russia, China, and India to do what they're doing is very real. So Mr. Global is not on the other side. Mr. Global is probably, you know, it's always on both sides.
Sure.
I don't know if you just saw the headline, and I haven't been able to confirm it yet. Naomi Wolf coming out on War Room and saying it turns out that a significant number of the Pfizer vaccines were made in China. And that was undisclosed. Now,
we'll get to another non-disclosure story in a little bit.
If that's the case, it's another example of things are not, you know, they're making it look like there's a war and there's tension, but there's a lot of cooperation going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right. But they're on both sides for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Next story. This is an interesting take on interest rates and inflation. Why raising interest rates to reduce inflation may work out very badly. So they link it to energy, saying look at this energy, look at this increase, you know, historically, okay. And they said now my concern is that the current attempt to bring down inflation will lead to falling energy supply and a world economy that is rapidly changing for the worse. Now, so this is inherently speculative because that graph, you know, that dotted line is the future. But he's saying, you know, if you look here, the total quantity of energy needed per capita has to keep rising to prevent very adverse outcomes. I mean, if you look at world energy consumption, you know, you see what happens here with world energy consumption per capita and how it's linked to recessions. And he's got two examples here. This is the story with the graphs, by the way. Mm-hmm. 2009, 2008 recession, 2020 shutdowns. You know, energy is not keeping up with population growth. That's a bad thing. Similar to the situation in the 30s. This says the economy is doing poorly. So we can look back and see how rising interest rates were used to slow the world economy in 2004 and 2006 period. So he cites this. He says, you see this here? This came from 2004, 2006, when the Fed was raising interest rates, okay? So that's his contention. And he says, you know, in those previous times, you had sort of miraculous things come along and bail us out in terms of energy. And then I'm just going to kind of cut to the chase here. So back to 2001, the world economy got a bailout from China's rapid growth in coal production. And he said back in 2010 and 2011, the bailout was shale oil in the U.S. And he says, now there's no bailout left. A lot of responses here on this. Anyway, that's basically the article. It's interesting. I'm still not sure I ever got over, like, did you really separate the tail and the dog from which one's wagging the other one?
Right.
But it's an interesting take.
So my take is what he's saying is the same thing we keep hearing again and again, week after week. Real assets matter.
Yes.
You know, the game of printing money to try and bubble your way out of what Jimmy Rogers used to call peak everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, that game's up. Because, and part of it is the commodities producers are saying, you know, it was that speech from Putin. He said the Fed created 5.9 trillion, ECB created 2.5 trillion, the other central banks created more. And what he's saying is, why should we swap real oil for depreciated dollars?
Yeah.
So.
Right. Right. And this is a big problem because, as you know, right before we started recording this program, the release comes out for the CPI, Consumer Price Index.
Whoa. And it was
came in at 9.1%, which is way higher than the 8.8% expectations. That tells you the Fed is probably really going to try to clamp down and keep raising rates.
Right.
If this article is right and it's really linked to energy and that creates a dip, we're in, and there's no bailout this time in terms of energy, we're in for real troubled water.
So I did this on Coast to Coast this morning. I think I sent you the survey. There is a new survey of small business. 35% say they didn't pay their June rent. 51%, this is U.S., so I'll just qualify this. 51% said that they don't anticipate being in business in 6 months. A little bit more than 70% of the restaurants say they don't plan to be in business in 6 months. Now, small business is the employment engine.
Yeah, right.
So you're talking about an economy that's just going to go like this.
Not looking good.
No. Nope.
Right.
No.
Yeah, I just scanned that survey. I didn't really thoroughly, but I saw it enough to be like really alarmed because you're exactly right. Small businesses provide employment.
Right.
It's not from big corporations.
Right.
You know, Twitter has something like, you know, 300 employees, maybe 400 now.
Right.
You know.
Well, I'm telling everybody who listens to this, use cash, because right now the financial payment systems are skimming anywhere from 2 to 5% off of every transaction. If that 2 to 5% could drop back into the pocketbooks of the small business, you know, some of those guys would make it.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, let's keep it going with this is the rules-based order of this next story. This is, yeah. Build Back Better 2.0, Global Elite's rebrand to rules-based world order. Okay. So let's just zoom in. In demonstrating their supposed moral superiority, our ruling class is now coalescing behind what they refer to as the rules-based world order. Okay. What is that? The rules-based world order, a bumper sticker slogan that has united the rulers of the Anglosphere, EU, and NATO powers against their foreign and domestic enemies, is easy to define once you understand what they mean by the word rules. These rules are necessarily malleable, as our rulers have spent the last decades trying to justify their routine invasions of foreign nations under the banner of democracy, freedom, and the like. In other words, the long story short is rules-based order means whatever we happen to say now, all it is it's not an accident that we're moving from the rule of law to the rule of man,
right.
Rule by committee, rule by right. Elite criminals. And they're, what they're trying to do is gloss it over and replace rule of law with something that sounds like rule of law. Like, oh, well, it's rules-based order. That's okay. It's
we not. Make the rules and we make them up every day. And whatever we say the rule is today, that's the rule. But here's what. You know, one of the things that focused on me, because I listened to a whole bunch of the videos, you know, somebody would excerpt out and you could listen to everybody saying rules-based and liberal. And all I can say is, why in the world did Hill and Knowlton think this would work? In other words, there's something... You know, somebody clearly decided that this was the new spin and they thought it would work. But it's so, I don't know, to me it just strikes me as highly ineffective and stupid. Is that...
There's a big portion of the population that'll go for it.
You think?
You'd be like, oh, okay, yeah. Do I think? Yeah. Look at, I see the lines of people to get vaccinated. I know. I don't think.
Right. I just have to sound like a broken record. I think you need military-grade neurological weapons to make that go.
It's audacious, and it's out in the open, graft in your face.
Right.
But there's a big segment of the population who just reads, they scan the headline, that's it. The world is okay, everything's fine. Rules-based order, that's the same thing as rule of law, fine. Don't even think about it. Keep going.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Keep them away from me.
Yeah, me too. Okay, next story. German banks Prepare for companies to default on loans due to energy crunch. Back to the energy theme, German banks are preparing for a possible influx of companies defaulting on their loans as the country faces a looming energy shortage. German Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck earlier warned that the country could experience a collapse similar to the one in 2008 if the problem's not addressed. He says, quote, companies would have to stop production and lay off their workers. Supply chains would collapse. People would go into debt to pay their heating bills, and those people would become poorer, he said. And then the head of Germany's Federal Network Agency, which regulates electricity and gas usage, called on the rest of the population to reduce their energy consumption in order to minimize the impact of the supply cut. So in other words, you know, you're the problem. You have to cut back on your energy.
Other than an occupying army, I cannot fathom why the Germans are going along with this. I told you when I was in Sweden, one investor said they think they're going to get the Ukraine. I just don't see how this is supposed to work.
I saw a different take in a comment section on a blog from a German who said, this rang true to me. He says, you don't understand Germany. It's a national pastime and a national occupation just to obey whatever rule the government throws
out. That's true.
So he says, the pain threshold here has got to be very high.
Right, but traditionally, the German industrialists and the German corporations were at the heart of the creation of the EU. They're the power. So
right. That's why the EU has the veto power. Right.
One person. This is going to slaughter their operations.
Yeah. Right. They're in trouble in the winter.
Right.
But yeah, they're the biggest exporter. There's the biggest economy in Europe. No doubt about it. They're the powerhouse. That's why, you know, when the EU was set up, they said, well, we're going to do everything with consensus. And really what that was is it allowed Germany to have veto. There's no consensus.
If you look at what's going on, it looks to me like China wins, Russia wins, U.S. wins, Germany dies.
Europe's not looking good right now.
No. Right? We'll look at the chart in a second.
We'll look at the chart in a little bit and see that.
Yeah, so the euro's back to parity with the dollar for the first time in 20 years.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Right, that's right in the chart, and we'll take a look at that. But right now, let's finish up with FedWatch, at least the financial part of FedWatch, with this story about CalPERS. A very interesting story here. CalPERS unloads record $6 billion of private equity stakes at discount. Okay? So the $440 billion public pension fund, the largest in the U.S., has cycled through four investment chiefs since 2009 and has long wrestled with the complexity of its $50 billion in private equity holdings. Isn't that amazing? That's a lot. CalPERS hired Jefferies Financial Group to explore ways to clean up its portfolio and shop a swath of assets, according to people familiar with the matter. Trading in such size came at a price. CalPERS sold its holdings at roughly a 10% discount to their value in September of 2021, some of the people said. The blockbuster transaction generates money for investment chief Nicole Musico, who took over earlier this year, I love this, to make new wagers, it's a casino there, as markets remain volatile. She was sold CalPERS directors that she wants to build a team that would buy stakes in private companies. That would let CalPERS gain more control and bypass private equity firms like Blackstone and Carlyle Equity Group. Interesting story. What's
so
your
this
read
is
on that?
Really interesting. If you look at her investment history and background, she was clearly hired to change the policy of working through intermediaries to going to direct investment.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, nobody, CalPERS, you've heard my CalPERS stories. CalPERS doesn't make a turn like this without tremendous top-down support from the top of the U.S. financial system. So, and when there's a recession, John, the one way you can improve investment returns is to just cut fees. And the private equity companies have taken big, big fees. So number one, this is a cut fees thing to do. Uh-huh. But the second thing then is, to what extent will a public pension fund doing direct investment internally fiddle with company policies like climate change? And so
great question, right?
The implementation of the sustainable development goals and a control system working through the capital allocation, you know, is a big question mark hanging over what we watch CalPERS do.
Yeah. I want to focus, you know, when I saw this story, I was like, what's going on here? So I looked her up. Obviously, she's young. But the thing that jumps up to me here is, zoom down to the bottom, this. She graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in kinesiology. It's like, that's a massage therapist or a PE coach.
No. Kinesiologist, the best medical person MBA. I ever saw was a kinesiologist. So I have to defend kinesiology.
Okay.
I do. I had a kinesiologist when I lived in New York. It was fabulous.
I didn't know what it was. I tried to ask my sister.
So it's almost like a chiropractor is in a, I mean, it's not an MD, but so I would defend a kinesiologist. If you look at her investment history, she has a lot of good experience. Oh, yeah. We're turning to my favorite guy. Okay.
Well, we're gonna get there in a minute. I jumped the gun a little bit there.
Well, but here's the thing.
You got a
whole world of intermediaries who've been throwing the weight around, skimming off the equity yields in the open market. And that has built up a real aristocracy of capital allocation in firms like Blackstone and Carlyle. And it's a great day to see them get cut out. Now, I don't want to see them get cut out and we go into some kind of woke nightmare. So let's hope that doesn't happen. But, you know, I can't tell you how great it is for the economy that whole group get cut out of the action.
That would be magnificent. Yes,
yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Anyway, since I jumped ahead, I jumped the gun. I'm going to just jump out of order here because this brings a smile to my face seeing this. And you'll understand why in a minute.
I love this guy.
Alan Grayson. To run for Congress. Now, they say he's running for Congress. He was in Congress before. So he's from Orlando, Democratic firebrand, so he's super liberal. Alan Grayson announced Tuesday he is running for Congress again, this time to succeed Val Demings as she runs for the U.S. Senate. Okay, so he's running again for the House. The decision by Grayson, who has represented parts of Central Florida twice in Congress between 2009 and 2017. So if I recall correctly, those terms were, it was two different terms.
Mm-hmm.
One was 2009, 2010, and the other was 15, 16, 17. Maybe it was three different terms, but there was a big gap between them.
Right.
And during the first term, okay, the first round, Grayson won. He was on the House Financial Services Committee. And that guy did some damage to the financial powers.
Let me just mention, when he got elected, he had been a very successful litigator and it had made, you know, he was worth more. His net worth was more than $100 million. And he'd made doing these big class action suits. So this was a guy who knew the way around the block and had a lot of financial independence and security, right?
Yeah. So right. I want to give you an example. Since some subscribers may not remember Grayson, it's been a while. It's been 12, 13 years since he was in Congress. What he would do to the Fed officials. He was a one man reign of terror against the Fed. The clip I'm going to play here is Grayson versus Scott Alvarez. Scott Alvarez, general counsel for the Federal Reserve. This is probably my favorite Grayson clip. And I have a lot of nine star
tens. Right.
This is a good one. Well, let's watch this clip. This is something else.
Federal Reserve ever tried to manipulate the U.S. stock market?
No, sir. Not that I'm aware of.
Not that you're aware of, but you're the attorney, right?
That's right.
So you might not even know, right?
I would expect to know if there were something like that being done. I'm not aware of that at all.
And if you did know, you'd be bound by attorney-client privilege, and you wouldn't be able to tell us, right?
Sir, if there were something the Federal Reserve were doing outside its legal authority, I would have an obligation to say something about that.
All right. So we agree that any participation by the Federal Reserve in the stock market or the futures market is outside the Federal Reserve's legal authority, right?
The Federal Reserve has some authority to regulate various aspects of markets and participate in markets in certain ways. So I think your question is too categorical, but...
I think not, actually. Why don't you answer it?
I don't know your question is so overbroad. I don't know where to begin to answer that.
I don't think it's that overbroad. I'd like you to tell me whether it's within the Federal Reserve's legal authority to try to manipulate the stock market or the futures market.
So I don't believe the Federal Reserve tries to manipulate the stock market.
Tries,
or the
come on.
No, so
do they?
The Federal Reserve's obligation and what it does in monetary policy is try to influence interest rates, and in that way to maximize employment and to stabilize prices.
Now, if in fact the Federal Reserve were trying to do that or doing it, isn't that something that we'd want to know?
And the extent that the Federal Reserve influences interest rates, it does make announcements of that decision immediately.
That's not what I said. I said manipulate the stock market or the futures market. Wouldn't we want to know? Yes or no?
Could you define what you mean by the...
I think you know what I mean, Mr. Alvarez. Now, wouldn't it be very helpful to have a GAO audit on that subject? Wouldn't it?
I don't know what it is that you're seeking to audit, sir.
What
I just
said.
It would be helpful if you could
outline. Let's go on to something else. Does the Federal Reserve actually possess all the gold that's listed on their balance sheet? Do they actually possess it?
Yes.
Has that been audited by the GAO?
All right, you got it.
Well, here's the thing. There's no mention that the New York Fed is agent for the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And the Exchange Stabilization Fund has broad powers to intercede in global markets. There's no mention of that. How can there be no mention of that?
The point of that exchange is to make it clear to viewers that the Fed is manipulating the stock market, which he just did.
Right.
It's very clear from that testimony that Alvarez is super uncomfortable, that the Fed's manipulating the stock market, and he is bending over backwards like Stretch Armstrong in a game of Twister,
right,
trying to get out from under those questions.
I will bet you a dollar that Alvarez does not know all the ways the Fed is manipulating the stock market. In other words, you certainly use interest rates to manipulate the stock market, and there are other things you can do to manipulate the stock market, but I think I think there are about 20 different ways the Fed has and is manipulating the stock market.
Oh, yeah. But I love the way Grayson reverse leaves it. He says, but you're the attorney. You wouldn't even know.
Well, but here's what I think is amazing. He got him to say on record that if they were breaking the law, he had an obligation to say something an attorney-client privilege wouldn't protect.
Right.
Now,
right.
That has to be a lie.
That's not true.
Yeah.
It's if you have an obligation, if someone is imminently going to commit a crime, Anyway. Okay, let's keep
it.
Grayson was this great. There's other clips with Bernanke and with Elizabeth Coleman, the comptroller, and he just saws them all in half. The one guy he didn't lay a glove on was Tim Geithner. I was disappointed.
Wonder why that is.
Because Geithner is a professional liar. He's really good. Okay, let's keep
going. Well, here's the thing. I mean, what I would have loved to see is Grayson really deep dive the SPVs, the off-balance sheet vehicles. That's
yeah.
What I would, as well as any transactions with the BIS.
The trouble with all this, that he only has 5 minutes.
Right. Right.
You know? I mean, it would take you 5 minutes to establish what a special purpose vehicle is.
That's true. That's true.
You just couldn't do it. I mean, if you give an hour, sure, it'd be great.
I would love to give him an unlimited amount of time asking the Fed questions.
Oh, yeah, that would be. Anyway.
Okay.
Let's keep it going. This is a crypto story. Key lawmaker, digital passport only way to deter crypto use for ransomware attacks. So they're hell-bent on this digital ID.
Yeah, they're trying to create as many justifications as possible.
Oh, yeah. So you got this guy, Democrat from Illinois, promoted the idea of regulating cryptocurrency exchanges by implementing a digital passport, saying it's the only way to make the industry less attractive to perpetrators of ransomware attacks and other transnational crime. You're ultimately going to need to have a uniquely identified, listen to this word salad, a uniquely identified biometrically deduped crypto driver's license, as it were, if you're really going to prevent it from being used for ransomware and all this sort of thing, Foster said. I mean, what a bunch of nonsense, you know? But they're hell bent on this digital ID.
Well, I sent you the email of the description of patents filed by three different automakers that would allow them to electronically monitor whether anybody was PCR positive in their car, in the car. I mean, can you imagine an electric car that can monitor your body?
When someone sends me stuff on, you know, I work in patents, right?
Right.
I've reviewed like 10,000 of them.
Right.
I just kind of tune out when I get patent stuff. It's just, it's like patents say everything. Okay, right. You get patents on time machines. I put zero stock in patents. You want to talk about claims and lawsuits? Different story.
No, I know. But I will tell you, they're planning, you know, I go back to the digital concentration camp. They want to turn a car into a digital concentration camp.
It pretty much already is.
Right. Not mine. It's pretty old.
Who was the reporter for the Rolling Stone? Who's Mercedes?
Right.
It was a 2000, and I remember. Yeah, the cars are already big trouble.
Right.
You know, right. Anyway. Okay, next up in FedWatch, this is from South Africa. Electricity crisis. No power for up to 6 hours. And you can see this is big trouble. People are experiencing rolling blackouts of up to 6 hours a day. And they're having to face a bitterly cold winter with an erratic, unreliable power supply. A typical day of what the state-run power company Eskom euphemistically calls Stage 6 load shedding consists of waking up to no power, driving to work through congested roads because the traffic lights aren't working. I thought they were in a separate system. Being pummeled by the din of generators at the workplace, and then finding power has been cut once more when you get back home.
So wow. We have subscribers in South Africa, and they are literally getting, you know, they have these special apps where they tell them, okay, we're cutting power 2 hours this morning, and then they're trying to tell people when the cuts will be, and they're getting like 4 to 6 hours a day interspersed throughout the day. And what's happening is it's just driving their productivity down. They're finding it exceptionally difficult to function. And this is one of the reasons when I first moved into my home in Tennessee, I installed a generator and a propane tank and a whole backup systems because I was anticipating going into a world of intermittent power. And at the time I was an investment advisor and I couldn't get knocked off. Anyway, so I wanted to cover this, John, because I think it's very important. Many people listening to this live in a place where they've always gotten fairly reliable utility services. And, you know, some are an exception. We remember in Kentucky when, you know, a big part of Kentucky lost 3 weeks, energy for 3 weeks. But don't think in terms of, you know, the big financial apocalypse. That's not what's coming. What's coming is these kinds of situations that really impact your productivity and your business and your life. And you need to be, you know, you need to be building the resiliency before you need it.
Yeah.
Right.
By the time you, right. Don't wait. Don't get caught short.
Right. So think about how you're going to deal with intermittent power, because for sure it's coming.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Okay. Next story in FedWatch, the last one of that category, Uvalde shooting investigation. Doesn't make sense. This is a BitChute video with Kelly O'Meara. Her show is called Don't Ask That Question. I misinterpreted that. I thought Don't Ask That Question means I'm going to ask a bunch of questions that don't want to be answered. Actually, Don't Ask That Question means don't ask the question, was it staged, which she never does. I watched the whole video. But she does raise a lot of points in this video about the Uvalde shooting, about what is going on there. And I will tell you, It's Wednesday, okay? So we're recording this on July 13th.
Right.
This morning, Citizen Free Press, okay, the guy who runs that website is a friend of mine. I know him. I know Kane. I know him well. He just posted something of the video. The surveillance video of Uvalde shooting was released this morning. And guess what? The one question you wanted to know, which is, was the door for the gunman to get in locked or was it unlocked? Okay. They cut out that part of the video. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's Richard Nixon's 18 minute gap.
Right.
It's a 2 minute gap where they just say, no, we're just not going to release that. So you don't know how he got in. Yeah.
So I've never, you know, I've looked at a fair amount of school shootings, and then I finally realized, okay, each one is a 1,000-hour job, and I just give up.
Yeah.
But you know, the official story never makes any sense. And right. Kelly O'Meara is really an outstanding investigative reporter. She was the one who did all the missing money stories in the 2000s and really bushwhacked that whole story. But she's done a lot on school shootings, looking at the role of the sort of the drugs that the kids who are the patsies are on.
Yeah.
And she's done a lot with SSRIs and the drugging of kids. Anyway, she's really smart. And you dive into this one and you realize there's so many questions. I mean, I've never heard a shooting where the official narrative and the narrative was this far apart.
Yeah.
It's so bad. It's so obvious. And you think, are they just getting really sloppy?
I think that's part of it. And these things are just a dime a dozen. You know, we talked earlier that there was a book by a guy named Trevor Aronson called Terror Factory. It came out in January 2000.
He's got a reissuance coming out in November. So I ordered the old one, but I've also ordered the new one.
Yeah. He walks through about 500 of these so-called events.
Right.
And he says basically 499 of them were set up by the FBI.
Right.
So in other words, to me, the story there isn't that the patsies are on SSRIs. To me, the story is these events are set up.
Yes.
Okay. And by the way, when I did my first deep dive on one of these, which was like Sandy Hook and then the Boston Marathon bombing, was sort of back to back. One of the things I noticed, there was a lot of people doing coverage of this and a lot of people poking holes in the official narrative. And the best ones always used B-roll from foreign broadcasts. So you'd see like Japanese coverage of, say,
right.
and you can't follow it because it's in Japanese.
Right.
But you'd hear, Konnichiwa, Sandy Hook. And then you'd see this B-roll footage. And invariably, it would be footage of the event that you never saw in the U.S. of stuff like, what the hell is going on in this footage? And eventually you put it together like, you're being told 10% of that story.
Right.
And a lot of stuff's being withheld. This whole thing's just manufactured. A lot of these events are just completely,
right.
they're shot in different locations, different times. It is crazy.
Right. It's a reality TV show.
You got it. That's a great description
right.
of it.
Right. It's a reality TV show.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Let's go to CBDC and crypto. I love this next story. This is the story. This is another story where the graph shows up in the story. You got to see this. Okay. Crypto meltdown. This is just so great. Crypto meltdown claims Rolex and Patek Philippe as victims. Oh, do tell. So luxury watches here. What's going on? What's the connection here? When markets, they're talking about crypto markets. When markets began to whipsaw earlier this year against the backdrop of rising inflation and geopolitical tensions, some investors were keen to put their money into more tangible stores of value, such as Rolex. Consequently, a new breed of young timepiece traders joined longtime collectors. Whether they were novices or old hands, buyers all chased the same models. By February or March, the holy trinity of the most hyped watches, the Rolex Daytona, the Patek Philippe Nautilus, and the Royal Oak, I was going to call it the Royale, was trading for many multiples of their retail prices. So here
Jesus,
you go.
Can you believe this?
Look at this, okay? Here we go. This is the Patek Philippe here. Here's the original retail price. It was $35,000, okay? The peak price, because this is a used watch, is now $238,000. Okay? That's what's going on in this market. That's how insane it is. They have all these graphs. With the S&P flirting, S&P 500 flirting with the bear market and Bitcoin losing about 70% of its value since November, that demand is now evaporating. The average price of Rolex in the secondary market has fallen since April. And there's the graph again, making its appearance. Is that not fantastic?
I don't know. You know, I've always found these bubbles stupefying. I can't relate to them. And
okay, but if that's not enough of a warning, okay, to be a little bit wary of what's going on in the crypto space, maybe the next story we'll sort of bring you around. Here we go. Financial Times. Top Fed official warns of serious vulnerabilities in crypto industry. There's the inevitable Lael Brainard. Sector needs tighter regulation as it is susceptible to the same risk as traditional finance, Brainard says. Brainard told a Bank of England conference in London on Friday that crypto is not yet so large or so interconnected with traditional finance to pose systemic risk, okay? Key word here, yet. Okay,
right.
So they're using the same language here, the interconnected, that we need to come in and we do whatever we want because things are interconnected. Brainard's speech also focused on the stablecoin industry. So here we go. They're getting into this. This is the Fed. It is vital that stablecoins that purport to be redeemable at par in fiat currency on demand are subject to the types of prudential regulations that limit risk of runs. In other words, this is a repeat of the, I don't know if you remember, the Reserve Primary Fund breaking the book.
Right. I just saw a tweet from Gary Gensler talking about we can't let crypto escape traditional securities regulation and standards, something like this. And I'm thinking, this is the agency that approved FASB 56.
Yeah. Yeah, unbelievable. These are the people who didn't rein in any of these criminal banks, and the excuse they always used was, oh, it's a systemically important bank. Now they're using that same language to sort of say, well, we're just going to come in.
I will say this. Gensler looks like he's trying to rein in a little bit, but if you leave FASB 56 outstanding, the whole thing's a joke. The whole U.S. securities market is a complete joke. And you know, so it's hard to take this seriously. Now, the one thing I will say, when I first did due diligence of the crypto market, you basically had a lot of talented entrepreneurs who had no knowledge or experience of custodian operations or risk. They were completely oblivious to it. They just had no background in it. And you knew that this was a train wreck waiting to happen. The Financial Times just had a news story today on one of the big crypto lenders. And it's the same. It's a bunch of guys with no training or background in any of the custodian operations or risks.
Right.
They have no idea
what,
you know, and it's just like, this had to end this way.
I know, right?
You know, it had to end this way.
Right.
Anyway.
It's like you watch this movie and a guy shows up with a hockey mask and a flannel shirt and a chainsaw. It's like, what? What's the outcome? How's this going to come out? It's like, well, it's called crypto, so it's different.
We all knew, you know, we all knew it was inevitable. So that was the plan, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes. They're coming in. They're going to regulate. They're going to be all over this.
Right.
Okay. Let's change gears to Farmageddon. I love this first story. Judge deals blow to LAUSD student COVID vaccine mandate. That is Los Angeles, I believe. Finding the Board of Education's authority is great, but not unlimited. A judge Tuesday ruled in favor of a father of a 12-year-old student who challenged the Los Angeles Unified School District student coronavirus vaccine mandate, finding that the resolution approving the directive clashes with state law. Okay, this is the key part. The case brought by the father, who was identified in court papers only as GF and his son as DF. Okay, let's look at the argument he used that prevailed here. In a sworn declaration, GF, the father, says he believes the vaccine could irreparably harm his son, who has already contracted and recovered from the coronavirus and may have strong and natural immunity. Further, quoting from the affidavit, I worry that vaccinating him could prove even more dangerous now that he has had COVID-19. Among other things, I fear that the vaccination could overexcite his immune system and antibodies. Then, having weighed those risks against what he believes to be a statistically minuscule risk that his son will contract the coronavirus again, GF says he vehemently objects to the district's attempt to force his son's vaccination. So that's, I wanted to highlight that because that was a successful argument. In other words, I've had it before. The odds of me getting it again or being harmed are very low, and it's counterbalanced by the risk of the vaccine, and it worked. The judge went with them.
Right. Well, there's a lot of science behind that one. So not to say that science is always respected in the U.S. courts.
Yeah, I get it. Right. But it's interesting to see which arguments work with judges.
Yes.
You know, we've covered this before. Like, the religious exemption seemed to work. And for a long time, judges were like, oh, no, the science says whatever Fauci says it is. And now you're starting to see arguments like, well.
That's breaking down. Especially because we have Fauci on the record is disagreeing with himself constantly.
Right. Maybe, let time go on. People are like, this guy's a flake.
Right.
You know, anyway, good to see that argument prevail because it's a good one. All right. Keep it going at Farmageddon. Next story, another winner. I love this. More than 82 million doses of COVID-19 shots discarded in the U.S. due to low demand. Get a load of this. The CDC said that pharmacies, state health authorities, and federal agencies in the U.S. discarded 82 million doses of COVID-19 shots between December 2020 and May 22. So that's not that long. That's about 6 months, right?
Right.
And then they get on this expert here, Sheila Shenoy, MD, MPH, an infectious disease expert at Yale School of Medicine, said, it's a tremendous loss to a pandemic control, especially in the context of millions of people around the world who haven't even been able to get a first dose. And then I wanted to point out here, I'll come back to this in a minute. The two states that discarded the most doses of COVID shots were Oklahoma and Alaska. So good for those states discarding the shots. The reason I wanted to highlight that part where she says, oh, well, people around the world, this is going to waste. You sent me a story this morning saying the worldwide number of discarded COVID doses, the shot is over a billion. It's 1.1 billion.
Yep. How much did that cost?
It looks like they didn't go to waste. They would have been, they're just part of the international pile of discarded injections.
Well, if a billion have been basically thrown out, that's a billion that somebody was planning would be taken and weren't.
Right.
That tells you the pushback is stronger than people indicate.
Right. It's very strong.
Right.
It's very widespread. Next story, another winner in Farmageddon. Normally we get these depressing stories in Farmageddon, but they're all cutting our way this week. I love it.
Yep.
This headline's fantastic. I'm normally not such a fan of Great Gateway Pundit, but this is dynamite. Haiti did not vaccinate its citizens. Okay, so they didn't vaccinate its citizens. The current vax rate is 1.4%, yet the country has one of the lowest COVID death rates in the world. Weird, huh? Yeah, that is weird. Okay, here's another graph story. Okay, Haiti had not been affected by COVID, while the countries who did vaccinate the majority of their populations are struggling and telling their citizens they need more injections. I want to zoom in on this graph. Take a look at this. At the very right-hand side, you can see, okay, daily new confirmed COVID deaths per million people. Haiti's at the bottom.
Right.
The UK and the US, which are pushing the heck out of it, they're at the top.
Right.
But it's a tight band, but Haiti is at the bottom, and it shows you this whole thing. Oh, it's going to save you? It's just nonsense.
Haiti has a remarkably interesting history, which we won't go into today. But if there's any country in the world that understands the G7 establishment is not to be trusted, it's Haiti. It's incredible what they've been through and what they know. Yeah. We had a great interview with a scientist who is now an American, is a journalist, but was from Haiti, and wrote a great book about the sort of takeover by the Clintons in Haiti. And I think her name is Cherry Daddy. And I just can't, the words cannot express how much the Haitian people, how sophisticated they are about deep state politics.
Well, especially after the visit by the Clintons, right?
Right. Well, yeah. My theory is one of the reasons I believe they canceled the African slave trade is they couldn't put down the Haiti rebellion. And they sent several armies to try and put it down, and they couldn't. And, so I think the G7 nations have always had a grudge against Haiti. Yeah.
Big time.
So they sent in the Clintons to get them back. Right.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Last story in Farmageddon. This is more along the lines of a typical Farmageddon story. Hong Kong to introduce electronic tracking bracelets to stop residents from breaking COVID quarantine. How about that? Health Minister said on Monday, July 11th, that all COVID patients under home quarantine will have to wear an electronic bracelet in order to prevent them from leaving home. Wonderful. Following along the lines of China's health code system, which uses a traffic light system for COVID, you know, green, yellow, red, Low said Hong Kong's leave home safe code would now be turned red for PCR positive residents to prevent them from all public venues, and giving a yellow code to overseas arrivals under mandatory quarantine. The government will also consider replacing part of the 7-day mandatory hotel quarantine with a health monitor at home. Wow. Are you kidding me?
For years, Hong Kong was always voted the most innovative city in the world. And so to watch this happen to Hong Kong is very depressing. You know, I lived there for a year. I loved it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I lived there for a year from, it was 1970 and 71. I was studying Chinese at the Yale and China Language Institute at the Chinese University. And it was one of the most free and inspired places on the planet. It was incredible.
Wow.
You had the Brits, you had the Chinese, you had the Indians. They all hated each other, but they all did business with each other. You know, it was kind of a love-hate, multicultural relationship. But you had people from all over the world. So I worked, I had a job in a nightclub in Central District. So I'd go to school during the day, and I'd learn my characters while I was being the disc jockey or being the bartender. And but we had people from all over the world. You know, there were, wow, at any given night in the nightclub, we had like 20 or 30. It was tiny. 20 or 30 different nationalities, and everybody got along, you know, because the culture was entrepreneurial, and it was all trade and very innovative. And, you know, it was kind of, you know, it was a tough place, but it was a free place.
Yeah.
And you just can't imagine Hong Kong being like this. It's sad.
I know. I wonder how many people in the U.S. would be in favor of ankle bracelets with COVID warnings like that.
You know, can't leave. Propaganda and mind control can achieve great things, and I hate
that's
to say,
why I'm with you. I think there's a significant portion of the population in the U.S. that would get behind that. Like, oh yeah,
not Tennessee,
right?
Not
right.
Tennessee.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's change gears to favorite topic: pushback.
Yep.
Here we go. Dutch farmers. I know you love this. This is from the Off Guardian. And this writer, Kit Knightley,
I like Kit Knightley a lot. Yeah. I was just on a panel with him. Whitney Webb had him on a panel with me. I think he's very capable. Yeah,
I agree. As a young guy, too, I think. Dutch farmers' protests and the war on food. Let's just kind of highlight. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. He's talking about media weasel wording, and he's getting what's the reality of the Dutch farmers' protest? The media spins it as it's a protest. They're protesting emissions targets. And he says, you know, the government policy being protested is a 25 billion euro investment reducing levels of nitrogen pollution. True, but it plans to achieve this by paying some Dutch livestock farmers to relocate or exit the industry. In real terms, this ultimately means reducing the number of pigs, chickens, and cows by about 30%. That's what's being protested here, the deliberate shrinking of the farming sector.
You're forcing the farmers to sell in a way that when they sell, it dramatically reduces the value. So this is an expropriation. It's not 100%, but whatever the percentage is, this is a serious, I would describe this as a serious theft of property rights. And if you look at the hypocrisy with which it's delivered, you know, we got F-35 from NATO or the Dutch Air Force flying back and forth over the North Sea all the time. And nobody's shutting them down, right? And whatever the environmental problems, you know, nuclear testing is not a problem. NATO's not a problem. The war in Ukraine's not a problem. It's cows and pigs and sheep. You know, the whole thing doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't hold together. And the hypocrisy is off the charts. So right. I don't know if you remember this. You know, there's a big fight in Rotterdam because they wanted to take, there was a real push to take one of the old bridges down so that Jeff Bezos' new $500 million yacht could sail out, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Come on. You know, but we have a climate change problem, really? I don't think so.
Yeah,
right.
But, that story, interestingly, they're trying to sell it to media as reducing nitrogen levels. And it harkens back to a story we covered last week with the Supreme Court and the EPA decision, where the EPA is like, we're just regulating the levels. And it's like, no, you're regulating a whole industry out of existence.
Right.
So don't try to soft soap it that way. It's exactly what the media is doing there that Knightley is talking about.
The government is coming in and saying, we're going to destroy your business. It's just like in coronavirus saying, your business is non-essential, but Costco next door is essential.
Yeah.
You know,
it's picking winners. It's picking winners and losers.
Well, but there's something else. And this goes
back to the rules-based order in action right there.
So the survey we talked about with small business, from the mid-90s on, there has been a war going on globally against small business. And you know, this is the next layer of that war. It's now you're just using rules and the rules-based order to destroy people's businesses.
You got it.
Right.
Yeah. The gloves are off. Yeah.
The gloves are off. That's why I'm telling you, they want a whole new group of people who are new, who are mean enough. They're looking for meanies.
I hope you're wrong about that.
I don't think I'm wrong. I think we got to get ready to... You know, it's what the character in Yellowstone said, you know, the trick is to learn how to deal with evil and still love your family and enjoy a sunset. He says you got to be meaner than evil, but you got to still love your family and enjoy a sunset. So I just want us to be ready to play to win in the fall.
All right. Okay. On that note, playing to win in Italy. We have Italy, Italians protesting the prime minister over there. The story here is, let's just take a look at this footage. This is a protest. Let's just watch this protesting the prime minister. Look, get a load of this. Wow.
I love the Italians. I love the Italians. Renato Holstein just got a great decision from an Italian judge. So, I was in last year with Bobby Kennedy. We spoke in Milan. And the Italians know. The Italians are so intelligent. But the thing I love about the Italians, they have so much, you know, they're not atomized. These are people who love their family. They love communities. They talk to each other. You can't get these people locked down. You know what I mean? You know, if you stop in Italy to have an espresso, you know, you use the ladies' room, get an espresso, and suddenly, you know, at the food bar, they're all like talking to each other, even though they're complete strangers. You don't see that in America, you know, in Starbucks, everybody's in their own little table. These people are all like meeting each other and talk. Oh, wow, I love your sweater. And where'd you get that? And, you know, they're just like, they're like puppies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So when the Italians protest, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
right. Okay. Next story, back to farmers. Farmers are rising up from Citizen Free Press. And it just, there's a series of just farmers around the world rising up in sympathy with the Dutch farmers. Polish farmers, here we go. Let's take a look at this. You got to click on each link. May take a while for these links to load. Anyway, you can look at the story. It's in the links and see that basically around the world, you know, protesters are, you know, the people are protesting in sympathy with the farmers.
If you're going to have central control, you got to control the food supply. And that means you got to put the small farmers out of business. You got to industrialize the food supply even more than it is. And the farmers are fighting back. And the farmers.
Big time. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody said to me the other day, well, there are two sides to this story. I said, no, they're not. If you like food, there are no two sides to this story. You know, you either have successful independent farmers or you're not going to eat, or you're going to be eating synthetic meat, you know, care of Bill Gates.
Yeah.
So there's no two sides to the story, because if they come steal the farmer's property, you know, once they finish stealing the farmer's property, they're going to steal yours. So
exactly. The precedent has been set.
Right.
Yeah.
the rules-based order means, you know, they're going to tear up property rights in the Constitution, and that's criminal and illegal. They don't have the law behind them, no matter what they call the rules.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Next story, last story in Fishback, Uruguay, halts COVID-19 vaccine for kids under 13. Judge demands government officials turn over Pfizer contracts.
I cannot wait to hear and see and read these contracts.
This is interesting. Let me try that one more time. Uruguay suspended COVID-19 vaccines for children under 13 after a judge issued an injunction halting vaccination in that age group until government officials turn over contracts between Pfizer and the Uruguayan government. According to ABC News, the judge received answers to 18 questions that he posed about the safety and chemical composition of COVID-19 vaccines signed by Health Minister Salinas, but did not turn over the contracts. Alvaro Delgado, the secretary of the presidency, said the halt that the judge put in place is a threat to public health. We're convinced that it's crazy to suspend voluntary vaccination because it has a strong scientific backing, Delgado said at a news conference. But the judge is seeking, among other things, to know whether there are clauses in the contracts that promised pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer civil and criminal immunity for adverse effects caused by their vaccines. Wow. He wants to know.
I would love to be able to dig out and get complete transparency on all the contracts that all the vaccine makers have been signing with governments and various parties, as well as all the kickbacks. Because I think if you look at how Pfizer stock is traded and the economics around this business, I think the backdoor money on this stuff stinks to high heaven. So
yeah.
Every time a judge starts demanding more of those contracts, that, you know, this is very good news. That judge and another judge, the Italian judge, are going to be hero of the week next week. So stay tuned.
Good.
We think this is important.
I want the subscribers to think about what's going on there. The health secretary is like, oh, science. This is anti-science. Saying, in effect, that the science campaign is more important than contracts. I don't care, in other words, that contracts may exist between Pfizer and our government that give them criminal immunity. In other words, they might have perpetrated fraud. They might be killing you. They might be murdering you. You're not entitled to know that. It's more important that we go ahead and vaccinate you because it's scientifically safe. Unbelievable.
Right.
Are you kidding me? Nope. That's just, wow.
Nope.
That's my Nuremberg candidate of the week. Uruguayan health secretary.
No, what about the Wisconsin Supreme Court? Have you seen that one yet?
I scanned it, but I haven't really read it.
All right.
Man, all bad. Okay. Charts. You ready?
Charts, you ready? Yep.
Yeah. Okay, here's what we're talking about. U.S. dollar versus euro. Here we
parity.
Go.
Parity. Yeah, so they weren't quite at parity. They were almost there, but now they're at parity for the first time in 20 years.
In 20 years, since sometime in 2002.
Yeah.
Unreal.
I'm going to go check the prices right now. Yep. Okay, I'm just looking at U.S. Because the U.S. dollar index has been flying, so as it rises, the euro has been, that relationship has gotten slammed. So I'm telling you, it looks like a war on Europe and really Germany. That's what this looks like.
That chart is astonishing.
Whatever the multipolar war is really about, Germany is the loser.
Big time.
And if the sanctions continue to hit energy and German industry with energy the way they're predicting, I can't imagine how bad this is going to be. Germany's in real trouble.
Those companies are filing bankruptcy now, right? We saw that story. What do you think they're going to be doing in the winter?
Right.
When energy represents a bigger portion of their costs.
Right.
You know, it's going to get worse. Okay.
Yep.
Let's keep it going on charts. Next up, U.S. dollar index, 108.
Yeah, so I wanted to check the U.S. dollar index because that Justin made that chart yesterday. So I want to see where we are today because it had backed off a little bit below 107. Let me just go to the new chart. Yeah, so it was backing down a little. Yeah, so it's 107.5. It hit 108.5, and now it's back down to 107.5.
Wow. Yeah.
But what I have to tell you is you're hearing, so again, that's almost 20 years.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is the bear trap rally. You're talking about the whole emerging market. Anybody who's borrowed in dollars and now with the recession has a much harder time to earn dollars, you know, and it's going against their currency this way. It's unbelievable. This is a huge swing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Next up, 3-month commodities.
Right. So not much has changed from last week when we talked about the fact that it really does look like the rising interest rates is bringing some of the air out of the balloon, which was why if you look at the money supply, we'll have a chart soon. You know, it really did look like it was turning down. And you talked last time about the flattening of the money supply.
Well, we can cut to that now. I'll show you a couple graphs here. Let me blow these up. Can you see this?
Right. So it's just starting to turn in May.
Yeah, this is but this is M2. I'm not a fan of M2.
No, M2 doesn't necessarily tell you that much.
If the Fed plays games, let's look at deposits. This is, to me, it's like, let's get real. How much money's in the bank? And here you go. You can see here.
Now that's a flattening. It's not a fall, but it's really a flattening.
It's been flat for 4 months now.
Right.
In an economy that's expanding by population, that's a real problem.
Right, but remember productivity falling significantly.
Yeah.
So with that much air coming out of the balloon in terms of commodity prices, that's why that CPI number was not good news at all.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Because it's not cooling, it's heating. The heating continues.
Right. Right. And the PPI is coming out, I think, next week. We'll see how that looks.
Well, what Putin and Russia and China are saying is you're not going to keep exporting the inflation to us. So now we're going to eat more of it.
Right. Very good point. Yeah.
So show the 1-year FinViz chart.
There you go.
Yeah. So as you can see, on the 1 year, a lot more is up than on the 3 months.
Yeah. The oil, natural gas, 68% and 66%, up.
Right.
You know, and even, you know, normally these charts, lumber is kind of way down. It's mid-range here. You know. So it's all kind of up there. It's really the financial stuff that's down here and the real stuff.
But silver is getting slaughtered. You know, and I keep laughing because the more it gets slaughtered, the more I buy.
Yeah.
But if you look at the chart,
you're laughing a lot.
Well, here's the thing. If you look at the silver chart, it could fall a lot more before this turns around.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Keep it going. Let's go to stocks.
Yeah. So, and gold. So China now falling even worse than the S&P. So S&P now down 18% for the year, China down 20%. Gold was flat. Now it's down almost 5%. And of course, the long treasury, the worst, down 21%, even though the rise in interest rates backed off a little bit. But it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if the Fed keeps bumping, if the Fed bumps another 25 or 50 basis points next time around, you know, you're going to see TLT down as much as it was in March.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
There's no winners there.
No, the pain is far from over.
Yeah, the CPI number speaks to that.
Yeah. Next week, I'll be doing the equity overview, so we'll be looking at the Rambus chartology. So it'll be very interesting to see what Rambus says this time around.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right, for now, let's go to Bitcoin. What do we got?
So Bitcoin's back to about 19,500, and it's gotten very little bump from the BIS saying its members can hold 1% of their reserves in Bitcoin. And so it's just bouncing around. So whatever you do, John, don't run out and buy a Rolex watch, okay?
Oh, good. God, don't worry about that. I was going to buy a Patek Philippe or a Royale. Okay. All right. Let's see what else we got. Ah, here we are. It's Hero previous wrap-ups connections. Happy Bastille Day. There we go. Anything to add to that?
No, I love it when the French celebrate independence. And I used to be a waitress and a bartender in a French restaurant, and our biggest day of the year was Bastille Day. We had a huge Bastille Day celebration. So I've always loved Bastille Day, but I just think we have to be inspired by the spirit of independence whenever we can. We can't get too depressed about how bad things we are. We have to remember, you know, we can gather and push back.
Do you know what the biggest bar day in the U.S. is?
No. What is it?
It's Black Wednesday. The Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Really?
Everybody's off. Yeah. Yeah. I knew bartenders. Yeah, Black Wednesday.
See, the biggest bar I ever worked, you know, I did the place in Hong Kong, but was at the University of Pennsylvania. So everybody went home before Thanksgiving. So that was never, Black Wednesday was never a big day for us. The big day, believe it or not, and it's the reason we have money, we publish money in markets on Thursday. So when I was in bar business, Thursday was the biggest night. That was always the biggest night. You know, Friday night was family night. Saturday was, you know, go out to dinner together, romance. So, but party time was Thursday night.
Anyway. Yeah, I think that's probably still true. Okay, hero of the week, you ready?
This is a great man. Dr. Vladimir Zelenko. Zelenko was the guy who, he was a family doctor. He had a wife and 8 kids in Orange County, right above New York. So New York State. He had 6,000 patients. And when COVID hit, you know, he was on a tear to figure out how to treat them. And he came up with the Zelenko protocols, which is hydroxychloroquine, zinc, vitamin D. And he was the one that somehow managed, he had personal connections being New York to Trump. And he's the one who got Trump all hepped up on hydroxychloroquine. Anyway, but Zelenko, if you go back to the post, Zelenko really fought hard to get the truth about the pandemic to a variety of places. And if you go down to the bottom, I want to show you.
Well, I can't because it's just an image. It's a static image.
At the bottom of the commentary, we have the video of him testifying in Israel. There's a rabbinical health board. I don't know how the government is organized, but it's one of the most amazing testimonies I've ever seen, because finally he's just berating these guys. How can you mandate these injections? They're terrible, on and on. And he's got chapter and verse. He's got facts. He's got, and he's a brilliant man, but he's got a huge heart, and he's very he's very effective at communicating. Anyway, so finally, at the end, one of the rabbis is feeling really guilty and shameful about what's going on. So he thanks Zelenko for the Zelenko protocols, because that's what he used to heal himself when he and his family got COVID. And Zelenko goes ballistic and says, how dare you deny to the Israeli people the very drugs you are using to heal yourself and your family? And he just goes, you know, he goes ape on him. It's unbelievable. And it's one of the most beautiful scenes I ever saw. I mean, it's the best of the pandemic, because what you're watching is a true doctor.
Yeah.
You know, what's happened in the last 2 years has caused us to forget what a true doctor is. This guy was about as true a doctor as you could get. Anyway, I loved him. We had him on our prayer list. We still do, because, you know, we just wanted this guy to live forever. And he was pretty young. He was, I think, 44, 45.
I think it's 48. 48. Well, we played that clip on Money and Markets that you're talking about. Yeah, right. Where he goes ballistic. Yeah. Okay. let's turn to this. Sovereignty now available on PDF.
Yeah, so the PDF is out. It's at the printers. The hard copy will mail in 2 weeks from the Netherlands to Europe and Asia, and then in another 2 weeks, so 4 weeks from Wisconsin in the United States anyway. But it's beautiful. We've got it up on, so just go into Solari, log in. And of course, the big theme is your peace sovereignty, which I can't wait to get in the hands of. You know, I've got shipments planned to lots of legislators. And I'm telling everybody, you know, buy multiple copies, give them to your legislators, because the legislators, this is the issue for a state legislator in the United States. Are you going to be able to hold the line of sovereignty or not? Because without sovereignty, there's no law. There's just the rules-based, make it up as you go every day, new world order. So the sovereignty piece is a great one, and the publishing people did a great job on this.
Oh,
graphics,
great.
Beautiful. We had a request from somebody who said they're too hard to download because they use a lot of
color.
Too much color. So we've put in a black and white compressed version. So for those of you who want to read it on your phone, we've.
Unrelated to that, was there also a correction? The show notes say a correction per email.
Oh, yeah, there was a correction. What was the correction?
Something to do with Trump.
Oh, right. So I talked about Trump taking us out of the WHO. And somebody pointed out that the way they'd done the money is they'd circulated the money back into Gavi. And in fact, you know, the Trump pulling us out of the WHO, I didn't print out the details. But once again, you know, what Trump says and what you think he did and what he really did are two different things. Yeah, somebody. Oh, Alex Berenson wrote a new piece. I don't think I sent it to you, saying the unvaxxed will protect us from Trump, because basically they'll never forgive Trump for Operation Warp Speed, you know, myself included.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Trump's dead, and long live DeSantis. So
yeah, right. Time for some new blood.
Well, you know, you really wonder whether or not DeSantis was allowed to do what he did on the theory that, okay, we need to get rid of Trump, and here's the guy to do it.
You wonder, you know, with Trump, it was like, are you kidding me? The guy's treasury secretary is from Goldman Sachs. And with DeSantis, like, the guy is from Harvard and Yale. That's the guy. Okay.
Well, DeSantis, if you look at DeSantis's history, he reminds me of a certain type that Harvard and Yale, and now when I say Harvard and Yale, I don't mean the colleges, I mean the corporations.
Right.
They love to get these guys from a working class or, you know, background. Steve Bannon was probably one of them. They bring them up through the ranks, and then they test them. So DeSantis went to law school, goes into the military. And if you look at what he handled for the military, it was some of the most sensitive cases the Navy and the military have had in the last, you know, in the last decade or two.
Really?
So yeah. Go to Wikipedia and read his history. It's a very interesting history as someone with a legal training and doing both military law and then doing politics.
Wow.
I'd be very interested to see what you see, but because throughout the pandemic, I kept saying, how is this guy getting away with this politically? Now, if you look at Florida has a lot of mafia money. And the mafia didn't, you know, the shutdown was not good for the mafia. So I think between the Navy and the mafia, maybe he had enough backing in those quarters. And the small business people, there's a lot of entrepreneurs in Florida. Who knows?
Yeah.
You wonder where his clout came from. Okay. Well,
it was
an exciting week.
A lot of action this week. More action every week.
I think it's going to be more action every week coming into September. And then the tsunami is going to hit, whatever it's going to be. And
I think the fall is going to be very, very busy for us.
Right. I do too.
Yeah. I do too.
Okay, John, have a great week.
Will do. I'm moving. This is the last episode of Money
right.
Markets that's being shot in Vietnam, Indiana, i.e. Amish country. Right? This is it. So
right.
I'm on the road soon.
Down to how many
sunny
days
NC.
Will it take you to get over to North Carolina?
With the truck and, you know, whatnot. I'm going to break it up into 2 days.
Okay.
I'm not going to do 700 miles in one fell swoop with furniture in a truck. Absolutely not.
Okay, well, traveling mercies. We hope it's a great move.
Thank you. I will see you next week. I'll be back in the CIA in the safe house.
Oh, that's you'll be in the safe house?
You'll be in the safe house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on Money and Markets. You have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
See ya.